We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 2nd. The first order of business will be approval of the minutes from February 25th. Representative Gunther moves approval of those minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. On a 1-0 vote, they pass. The first item on our agenda is an overview of the extended employment program from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. If testifiers like to come forward, and as always, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Hansen Willis. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And we are happy to be here this afternoon to talk to you about this program. As you know, one of DEED's primary responsibilities is to provide employment services for Minnesotans with significant disabilities. And and helping people with disabilities gain quality employment not only helps them to attain independence for themselves and their family, but also is essential to helping Minnesota's economy and our businesses continue to grow into the future. And as you may know now from our repeated presentations to this committee, we'd like to start always with a little bit of data. And the data suggests that we are doing better than most states in helping people with disabilities find and keep employment. And as you can see in this first slide in front of you, more than 29% of working-age Minnesotans with disabilities in Minnesota in 2014 were employed. This is an improvement from the recent years of the recession. Unfortunately, that's where most of the good news ends, because even though we're doing better than we were during the recession, people with disabilities in Minnesota are still about 43% less likely, 43% less likely than their non-disabled counterparts to have a job. We know that we can and must do better, not only for these Minnesotans, but for our growing economy. The extended employment program, the primary topic that we are going to focus on today, is a fantastic resource for Minnesota's workers and businesses and is a key part of this effort. This important program provides ongoing employment services for people with severe disabilities and the counseling to help them attain and keep employment, to advance their careers and to meet the needs of our growing economy. And so with me today is my colleague, Kim Peck, who oversees this program and all of our vocational rehabilitation efforts at DEED. And she's going to give you a closer look at this program and what the future holds for it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kimberly Peck. I'm the Director of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. And as you see in the slide before you, Vocational Rehabilitation Services is comprised of four programs. The first program listed there, Vocational Rehabilitation, is the largest of the four programs. It's a federal-state partnership and focuses primarily on providing time-limited short-term employment and training services to individuals with significant disabilities. The Independent Living Program, also a federal-state partnership, provides five core services ranging from independent living skills training, nursing home relocation, system advocacy, and the like, to assist individuals with significant disabilities to be able to be successful and remain in the community. The third program, Individual Emplacement and Support, we refer to that as IPS, is a specialized supported employment program for individuals with serious and persistent mental illness. And what sets IPS model apart from other supported employment programs is that the employment services and supports are embedded in the mental health treatment program. It's evidence-based and actually is very exciting to see the results of that as we move forward. The final program that's comprised of vocational rehabilitation services is the extended employment program, which is what the committee has asked for an overview today. Thank you, Jeremy. The extended employment program provides ongoing supports to individuals with the most significant disabilities. These supports are necessary for these individuals in order for them to retain and advance in their employment. It's funded by a $6.8 million state appropriation from the general fund, from the Workforce Development Fund, and a $5.7 million appropriation from the general fund. Aside from a small amount of funds that support the administrative staff at DEED that manage the extended employment program, the majority of these funds go out to 28 community providers who are certified annually and are required to achieve and maintain the highest levels of service standards and accountability to the people that they serve. The people that are served in the extended employment program, again, are individuals with the most significant disabilities. They have three or more functional limitations to employment, and that they require these ongoing supports in order to maintain and advance in their career. In 2014, the extended employment program served nearly 5,000 people. 5,000 Minnesotans, and these workers representing a wide range of disabilities, individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, individuals with serious mental illness, traumatic brain injury, individuals on the autism spectrum. Those individuals receive the ongoing employment supports necessary to add nearly 4 million work hours to the state's productive capacity, earning nearly $28 million in personal income, yielding a return on investment of over $2 for each one in the program.
A question for you. I apologize. I got caught writing my notes. It was $5.7 million from the general fund, and then what was the Workforce Development Fund amount?
It's $6.8 million from the Workforce Development Fund and $5.7 from the general fund.
And are those for fiscal years 14 and 15 or 16 and 17?
Those are 14 and 15.
Okay. Do you know what the projections are for 16 and 17 for those amounts? We can phone a friend down here. We can. Ms. Hendricks?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, also in your packet is an overview that Anita Newman from House Research and myself put together, with both an overview of the programs as well as the funding levels going back to fiscal year 2012 and forward to 2017. So the same numbers can be found in that. Might be a helpful kind of cheat sheet.
So in the future, I'll just read my packet. My apologies. Please proceed with your testimony.
Yes. On the next slide, you'll see that the extended employment program provides support to individuals with significant disabilities in one or more of three possible employment settings. The first setting, center-based employment, is essentially employment that's on the premises of extended employment provider, where the majority of workers are individuals with significant disabilities and the wages are typically less than minimum wage. Center-based employment is more commonly known as sheltered work. The second setting for extended employment work is community employment, where it's employment that's in the community, typically with individuals and individuals with disabilities that are working as part of a crew, such as a cleaning crew, and they are working, as I said, in the community, and they may or may not be earning above minimum wage. The third setting that extended employment services are provided in is supported employment, and that typically is the level of employment where individuals are working independently with supports, and they're working in a competitive setting and are being paid at least minimum wage. What's important to note is, regardless of the setting that extended employment workers are working in, it's important to note that absent the supports they get from the extended employment program, they would most likely not be able to maintain their job. And also, the majority of the extended employment workers may, in fact, be working in one or more settings. It's not uncommon for individuals to start out their day working in a center-based employment and then perhaps going out into the community as part of a crew to be working in a community-based employment setting. As you'll see on this graph, you'll see that over the last 25 years, certainly when we started with the extended employment program, the majority of the funds were being used to support individuals in facility-based employment or center-based employment. But with the signing of the ADA and with greater emphasis on supporting individuals with disabilities in community-based jobs, the investment of the extended employment program dollars shifted to supporting more people in community-based jobs. Currently, as in 2013, we have 81% of the extended employment dollars are used to support individuals in community-based jobs. And DEED, together with the extended employment providers, have worked collaboratively to shift those investments to support people working in the community. Recently, DEED has convened an extended employment rulemaking advisory group because we've recognized that it's time, with all of the changes that are happening in disability employment services, it's time to update the rule to make sure that the rule is aligned with the changes that have happened at the federal level and the state level. So this committee, in fact, will be reviewing a policy bill that is proposing some changes to the extended employment related statutes. Essentially, what this policy bill will be doing will be collapsing those three settings into two, a non-competitive setting and a supported employment, and it will be aligning definitions with the new definitions that we see in the Rehabilitation Act and other federal legislation. I want to take a minute to highlight the governor's proposal related to the extended employment program. And the governor is recommending that a one-time increase to the rates paid to extended employment providers be increased. The extended employment providers are paid a specified rate for each hour worked by an extended employment worker. And the extended employment program is funded on a totally outcome-based system. In other words, providers will earn their contract by reporting the number of hours worked by extended employment workers that are working with their organizations. In recent years, the providers have struggled with increased costs in staffing and benefits. The rates, frankly, haven't kept up with those costs. And so the legislature authorized a one-time increase in those rates. The governor is recommending that one-time increase be extended. And certainly from DEED's perspective, we believe that that's a modest and necessary increase. Because frankly, if that wasn't continued, then what would happen is that the extended employment providers would be facing a 2% cut in their rates and would likely have difficulty maintaining the current level of services that they provide. Also, I think it's important to note that over 55% of the extended employment workers live and work in Greater Minnesota, so providers in Greater Minnesota would certainly be impacted if the one-time increase was not continued into the base. I know that next on your agenda after the extended employment overview is a review of the Moore bill, which is putting in a request for transition dollars for extended employment providers in light of the Olmstead plan. And what I wanted to do this afternoon is to provide you a very brief kind of overview of the changes that are happening in disability employment services. I've had the privilege of being in this position, serving Minnesotans with disabilities for almost 10 years, and I have to say that there is today a sea change, a major transformation happening across the country in disability employment services. We're certainly seeing a lot of change happen here in Minnesota, but it is by no means limited to Minnesota. This is happening across the country. And as you see listed on the slide here, it really starts with the Americans with Disabilities Act that was signed in 1990 by President Bush. At that point in time, it was viewed as the most sweeping civil rights legislation ever to have been passed, targeted to individuals with disabilities. And in particular, Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act has been getting a lot of attention in the last several years. That section of the ADA basically articulates that unjustified segregation is, in fact, discriminating against individuals with disabilities, and so it cannot continue. That was really the substance of Title II. In 1999, the U.S. Supreme Court heard a case, Olmstead versus LC, and that is what you've probably come to hear about or know as the Olmstead decision. Essentially, what that decision said was that it reinforced Title II of the ADA and said that public entities have obligations to ensure that individuals with significant disabilities are not going to be unjustly segregated. In fact, what they called the integration mandate. What the Olmstead decision articulated is that public entities are required to provide community-based services to persons with disabilities when such services are appropriate, when the affected persons do not oppose community-based treatment, and community-based treatments can be reasonably accommodated. Now, the Olmstead decision was 1999, and states were dragging their feet a bit in implementing that decision, and so the Department of Justice in 2009 rigorously stepped up its enforcement of the Olmstead decision, and most notably cases in Rhode Island and in Oregon specifically called out sheltered workshops as being a violation of the ADA and contrary to the Olmstead decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1999. So that's an important backdrop to all of this sea change that's happening with disability employment, but that is not the only piece. On July 22nd of 2014, President Obama signed the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act that essentially reauthorizes the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which is the legislation that governs the public vocational rehabilitation program. In the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, clearly the legislation put a stake in the ground related to segregated employment. Specifically, effective July of 2016, it puts the VR program in a gatekeeper role to sheltered workshops. In order for youth with significant disabilities to be working in a segregated setting at subminimum wage, they have to first go through the VR door. For individuals that are already working, for adults that are already working in a subminimum wage in a sheltered workshop, effective July of 2016, the VR program will be expected to annually assess those individuals to see if they, in fact, can be successful in community-based employment. And if so, the expectation is that we provide them the supports and resources to be able to achieve that goal. So you have the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. Also, in March of 2014, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services published the final rule governing home and community-based services. While that rule doesn't directly impact individuals participating in the extended employment program, it certainly impacts the providers who are extended employment providers and also are serving individuals that are funded under the waiver programs. What the final rule requires is that individuals that are receiving employment services in waiver-funded programs must have full access to the benefits of community living and have the opportunity to receive services in the most integrated setting possible. Finally, you've probably heard that Minnesota settled a lawsuit, the Jensen case and the Jensen settlement that required the state of Minnesota to develop an Olmstead plan. The governor convened a subcabinet. That subcabinet has developed an Olmstead plan, and the overall goal of that plan, the Minnesota's Olmstead plan, is that Minnesota will be a place where people with disabilities are living, learning, working, and enjoying life in the most integrated setting. Specifically, as it relates to employment, the Minnesota Olmstead Plan calls for the expansion of integrated competitive employment for youth and adults with disabilities, aligning policies and fundings across agencies to expand integrated employment, including adopting an employment first policy, and providing training and technical assistance, public information, and outreach on employment in the most integrated setting. This is clearly a collaborative effort involving 8 agencies, including DEED. Now, when you saw that slide before that demonstrated the investment of the extended employment program in the late 80s, the majority of the investments were supporting individuals and supported employment. Today, 81% are supporting people in integrated employment, you'll see that the extended employment program really has led the way, if you will, in terms of transitioning the system to support individuals in the community. But it's important, I think, as you hear conversations around the Olmstead Plan, that you understand that it's not just the Minnesota Olmstead Plan, but it's changes at the federal level, in legislation, in rule, as well as in court action, that have brought us to this stage that says, yes, we have made progress, slow but sure progress, in assisting individuals with significant disabilities in finding and retaining employment in the community. But these changes require that states step up the pace and that we move much quicker. With that, I'll turn it back to Jeremy.
Mr. Hanson-Wallace.
Thank you, Kim, for that excellent overview of our program. Mr. Chair, that is the end of our presentation. We'd like to open ourselves up to questions at this time.
So before we go to Ms. Hendricks and Ms. Newman for their overview, we'll take questions from members of the committee. Representative Hortman and then Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Peck.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you used the phrase the VR door, and I'm guessing when you say VR, you mean vocational rehabilitation, with the idea being that somebody doesn't get into an opportunity where they're earning sub-minimum wage before we determine whether they're eligible for regular employment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. And clearly in the federal legislation, it was absolutely clear that Congress's intent was to direct the public vocational rehabilitation program to step up more assertively in reducing, if not eliminating, the tracking of youth with significant disabilities into sheltered workshops.
Representative Luna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, out in my real world, I have an insurance agency, and we utilize some of these people, these services, and it's actually been a strong asset for us. And when that got set up and on an ongoing basis, the caseworker, if you will, the person that was facilitating this, more or less coached me as to an income cap we were allowed that person was allowed to earn because of some type of penalty, and I'm blurry as to how that works, and so we could only offer so many hours a week to that. Could you explain how that works or what that would be?
Yeah.
To either of our testifiers?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Members, I presume that what you're referring to are the disincentives that exist if individuals are receiving public benefits, let's say, for instance, Social Security disability insurance. They have a limit to how much that they can earn before their benefits will be negatively impacted. That's one of the things that we've been working very hard in the public VR program is to provide information up front for individuals to really understand about if they go back to work, what will be the impact on their benefits. And frankly, there's a lot of misinformation out there. You know, we would love, frankly, to have the opportunity to have a conversation with that case manager because for the most part, Social Security disability is not a living wage. And so the more that people are able to be economically self-sufficient, I think that typically is the preferred route that individuals would like to go. And certainly, I think from a public policy perspective, that's the direction that we're moving in as well.
Representative Lunan, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In this instance, what happened was is the caseworker, and you know, probably well-intended, but created a situation where these employees of mine just would not work more hours. They were kind of coached away from it, and the trust factor was with the caseworker, not with me. And it was, I just see some opportunity there for, you know, there was more things that they could have done that would have helped our business, would have helped them and developed them, but that we had a cap on basically what they could take home every week.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Peck, it's good to see you again.
Thank you.
I'd like to know how they determine, like I had hired also these individuals at my grocery store in the past, and they would have a way they would determine what salary I would pay them. Based on what? Do you know?
Ms. Peck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, I would imagine that the situation that they're referring to may be a situation where individual is being paid less than minimum wage, and I understand from the Department of Labor that there are pretty rigid and strict processes that need to be followed to determine what the appropriate wage would be. There is a lot of conversation at the national level around the subminimum wage certificate, and in fact one of the components of the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act was creating an advisory committee to develop a report, to study and develop a report to go to the Department of Labor and Department of Education about the efficacy of continuing the subminimum wage certificate going forward. So I think that, again, part of that sea change is that there's really an examination of whether the subminimum wage certificates are, in fact, necessary anymore, as we can leverage assistive technology, as we can work with businesses to develop their ability to provide more natural supports. It certainly is our belief that more and more individuals with significant disabilities can work competitively and earn at least minimum wage.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the way I recall it is they would take one of my existing employees and have him do the task that this person was capable of doing, and they would time him with a stopwatch to see how he would compare with the employee I had and what he would do. And they would determine what percentage that person was doing of my existing employee. And that's how they would determine his salary or her salary. And they would reevaluate that every year or so, because hopefully they would gain proficiency and they would get more of a salary increase that way. So that's the way they worked with us, and I just assume that was typical all over.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, again, those productivity measures are used when individuals are being paid subminimum wage, because the entities, in this case the community provider, has to demonstrate to the Department of Labor that they are appropriately and accurately using those subminimum wage certificates. Again, however, that the conversation or the policy discussion that is emerging is whether those subminimum wage certificates are in fact necessary. And so I think the jury is out yet on that, but that is really part of the sea change that we're currently in the midst of.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney, and then Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have really about three questions here. They're all kind of related. How many disabled people could be served by you? I mean, what's the total population that is servable by your agency, and how many of them do you serve?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, in our comprehensive statewide needs assessment that we provide to our federal funder each year, we estimate that the number of individuals that would be eligible for services in the VR program to be about 150,000 people. In the VR program, we currently serve, at any point in time, there's roughly about between 18,000 to 20,000 people being served in VR. In the extended employment program, as I said, we're serving between 5,000 and 6,000 people, and that really is at capacity given the limited funds. The independent living program, you know, they have the opportunity to provide information referral services, so they do provide those services to tens of thousands of people, but individuals that actually have a service case with IL is roughly around 6,000 people.
Representative Mahoney?
And then in some of the notes that we have here, you talk about serving 5,000 Minnesotans a year. Is that a repeat? How many are new individuals that you help every year, or do you help the same 5,000 every year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that 5,000, for the most part, are people who are receiving ongoing supports. And so typically the only way that people will leave the extended employment program is if they retire or if they die. That's one of the challenges, frankly, because the system has been at capacity for so very long. And one of the challenges that we have in the public VR program is that one of our obligations is when we're working with people initially to provide that upfront skill training, we need to assess whether they need ongoing supports in order to be successful. And if they need those ongoing supports, but we can't find a resource for that, we're not to provide employment and training services to those individuals, because essentially we're not to set them up to fail. So that is a significant challenge in terms of, are there adequate ongoing supports for individuals with significant disabilities? I want to note, too, that DEED certainly provides, through the Extended Employment Program, provides services that provide ongoing supports. Those types of services are also funded under the waiver programs.
Representative Monty.
So I'm going to assume you have counselors that help these individuals with their extended employment. How many individuals does a particular counselor deal with as a case management process? Was it a one person per one counselor, or is it 10 people per counselor in a year?
Ms. Peck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, in the...
I appreciate the upgrade.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Mahoney. Representative Mahoney. In the VR program, the average caseload size for the VR counselor is between 80 to 120 cases. I can't speak to the number of cases that an extended employment job coach or employment specialist would carry. I would actually need to look to one of our community provider colleagues to provide that information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to double check again on the impact on the wage of the appropriation that's here. So it looks like one of the things we'd be doing would be preventing the basic wage rate for people on an extended employee from dropping to even more sub-minimum wage by this appropriation. But what then is the goal? At what rate? It says 406 now is what the rate is. What is the expected rate as a result of if we appropriate these dollars?
Ms. Beck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark. The rate that we pay the extended employment providers is different than the wage earned by the extended employment worker. All extended employment providers earn a set hourly rate per the setting of the services being provided. For instance, if an extended employment provider is supporting someone in supported employment, for every hour that individual is working in their job, the extended employment provider is paid, I believe, $4.09 per hour to provide those supports. And the amount decreases with competitive employment and center-based employment. And that's part of what you see, the transition of the investment of dollars over the years, is that the higher rate is paid to support individuals in supported employment. So the sub-minimum wage, or the wage paid to the worker, is unrelated to the rate that the extended employment providers get, only in the sense of what is the setting that the individual worker is employed in.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I guess maybe this is a more of a ongoing discussion, but is there any chance that some of that is passed on, or what kind of expectation is some of that increase would be passed on to the worker themselves?
Ms. Peck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, one of the advantages, as I understand it in talking with extended employment providers, is that the dollars that they earn in the extended employment program are relatively fungible, and that they can spend them really in whatever way makes the most sense. Now, whether that would be on staff increases, staff that are providing the supports, or whether they are in fact the employer of record, and whether that would translate into wage increases for the workers themselves, that would be a question that I would have to defer to the individual provider in those cases that they actually act as the employer.
So, Mr. Chairman, maybe this is just a question that we could get back to the committee, that come back to the committee, and I'd just like to know how we're doing in terms of wage rates in general for people in unextended employment. How has it changed? What kind of a historical review of where we've been with that subminimum wage and where we might, where you see us going? And I think it does impact the whole issue of people who are on some sort of like Social Security disability or other things, that how that affects them. And just, I guess I'm just curious as to how those things interact with each other, and whether or not, really whether or not people in those jobs can expect to have any sort of increase. I mean, it would seem like that might be kind of important for motivation and ongoing willingness to show up to work.
And I think, Representative Clark, you bring up a good point, and also the interaction with the higher minimum wages, that have higher minimum wage law that passed last year and as it is going forward. So any closing comments from our testifiers? Thank you very much for your presentation. Appreciate it today. Next, we're going to move on to Ms. Hendricks and Ms. Newman. We're going to provide an overview of the State Vocational and Rehabilitation Services and Olmsted Plan. You sure you don't want to go up to the testifiers table? And really? Oh, yeah, I think the chair wants you at the testifiers table today. You too, Ms. Newman. That way you get more faith. We're on TV today. And this way you can say hi to loved ones. And our staff is always so enthusiastic to be on TV.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so in your packet is this overview of DEED's vocational rehabilitation services, as well as on the second page, or on your, I think on the back side, the Minnesota Olmsted Plan, and with a particular emphasis on the funding levels for those programs. So I won't really go into detail. You can read it, and I think we've already heard from Deed about a lot of the details. They spoke mostly about that last program, the Extended Employment Program. So there's three more programs within vocational rehabilitation. The first two also receive federal funds. It's about a little over $50 million in total per year in federal funds. And then the table below that shows the state funding for these programs. So maybe to notice that most of the funds come from the general fund, except for $6.8 million ongoing money from the Workforce Development Fund for Extended Employment Program, that very last line. And another thing to note is that most of this money is ongoing and is in the base budget, with some one-time appropriations. And for instance, the Extended Employment Program that I just mentioned with the Workforce Development Funds, under 2015, fiscal year 2015, members should see a $7.08 million appropriation. So that is that $250,000 increase, one-time, that now, if you turn to the next page, the governor recommends to make that ongoing appropriation, and it would go into the base budget. In terms of the Minnesota Olmsted Plan, we put together a brief overview. Many of the facts have already been mentioned as well, but in terms of past funding, in 2014, the legislature appropriated $500,000 as a one-time in fiscal year 2015, and an ongoing $875,000 for fiscal years 2016 and 17 for the Olmsted Implementation Office. And that is to Deed, as Deed serves as the fiscal agent for this office, although the office is cross-agency. And then the recommendation from the governor for the 2016 and 17 biennium. I don't know if Ms. Newman wants to add anything.
Mr. Chair and members, no, Ms. Peck and Ms. Hendricks have already really covered the programs. I might point out, however, in response partially to Representative Clark's question about the wage rates, in the governor's, in the budget book, there is a breakdown of the average hourly wages for individuals in non-competitive programs versus the competitive employment programs. And that information indicates that the average hourly wage for persons employed in the non-competitive programs was $4.63 an hour. And for those individuals in those competitive employment programs, the average wage is $10.12.
Any closing or any additional comments before we go to member questions?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted a clarification, if I could. Is that after the appropriation? If the impact of the appropriation would raise it, then from what our information says, from $4.06 to $4.66, is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, the numbers in the governor's budget book are for the fiscal year 2014 numbers, so those would be under the current law. However, just to reiterate the point that Ms. Peck was making, is that there is the difference between the provider rate and the wage rate paid to the individual, and that is a significant difference in what that means.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I guess we just still need that information about what the actual rate is that the individual is earning, and then what the impact would be by this appropriation. If it can be known, it sounds like, Mr. Chairman, there's no definite requirement that an increase to the employer is passed on to the worker, and I guess that would be important to know.
Well, I'll let staff answer that question. Ms. Newman or Ms. Hendricks.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, the provider reimbursement rate, as Ms. Peck said, that is at the discretion of the provider, and for those providers that are actually the employers, that rate covers the administrative costs, plus they can augment the wage rate to the worker itself. But that is a discretionary item, and the numbers I gave you are would indicate the actual wage under current law that the workers are receiving.
Representative Clark, does that make sense? Or can I go back to and mention it again?
Mr. Chairman, but the $4.66 is what the employer is receiving.
That is the provider.
Yes, ma'am.
The employer.
The provider reimbursement rate.
Right. So okay. Mr. Chairman, do we actually have what the wage rate is?
I'd say, Representative Clark, and to the testifiers, why don't we kind of take this back from the top, just go to the beginning, and explain how, I guess, because we're dealing with a couple of different hypotheticals here of different programs. Let's start with those employees who are in, who are working in a center. I think the term they used was a closed workforce, and explain the funds that go into that program and the funds that go out of the program. Or would you prefer maybe we have DEED staff do that?
Mr. Chair and members, I think Ms. Peck is much more well-versed in how that works.
Thank you. So Ms. Peck, thank you very much for coming back to the table. And if we could just give us a single hypothetical of a worker who is using extended employment services to kind of walk through for members of the committee. I'm familiar with this program, but I think Representative Clark asked some good questions. Just kind of walk through a hypothetical employee. No need to go through all the possibles, but just give a situation and where what their wage is, how it's determined, where the assistance is coming from, what the private employer is actually paying for, what they receive. That may be helpful for Representative Clark and other members of the committee.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, what I would like to request is if we could ask one of the providers to come up and describe that very process, because, we reimburse the providers based on the hours that extended employee workers work, but the mechanics of it, truly, I can't speak to that as effectively. Steve Ditchler from PROACT is an extended employment provider, so with your permission, I'd like to ask him to come up and speak specifically in terms of how do they work that magic on their end.
I just noticed that Ms. Newman and Ms. Hendricks deftly came back to their spot at the committee table. Very shrewdly.
Smart women.
Yeah. So before, because you'll be testifying on Representative Gunther's bill, correct, sir? So are there any other questions for Ms. Hendricks or Ms. Newman before we go to Representative Gunther's bill? Okay. Very wise. Very good. All right. Thank you very much. So we'll just, with that, we'll conclude that portion. We'll go to Representative Gunther's bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Gunther, you want to head up to the table? Or?
Can't wait.
And then we'll eventually get to your question, the point, Steve. So. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Representative Bob Gunther, and I would like to move House File 1172 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And with that, I will try to describe the bill a little bit to you. DEED's Extended Employment Program provides ongoing support services necessary to maintain and advance the employment of individuals with severe disabilities to provide work in center-based employment, community employment, and supported employment sub-programs. House File 1172 increases the extended employment basic rates by $2 million to address the inadequate and growing disability workforce needs. And it provides $12 million in the Olmstead transition costs to extend employment providers for increased employment and supports in community-based settings. And with that, Mr. Chairman, Steve Ditchler will start out and tell everybody all they want to know about this program. I do know one thing. We took this committee to MRCI site in Fairmont years ago when McElroy was chairman, and it was a very learning experience, and sometime if we ever have time, we'll do that same thing.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Steve Ditchler, and I am the executive director of a community rehabilitation program called PROACT with headquarters in Eagan and providing services out of Eagan, Red Wing, Zumbrota, and Hudson, Wisconsin. One of those sets of services are extended employment. I'm here on behalf today to represent MORE, our state association. Before I do that, though, I express our appreciation, Chair Garofalo and the committee for hearing us. A special thanks to Representative Gunther for being the chief author on our bill and the co-authors, Representatives Mahoney, O'Neill, and Isaacson. And actually the department for working with the governor to get that $500,000 in his budget to at least not go backwards if we can't make any step forwards here. I will go on with this, but I am happy to address some of the wage issues. Actually, I want to do that, but maybe I should get through this part first because it was hard to sit there and at least believe I have some insight I can offer and not share that, though. But just for myself, I think a few of you know me and some of my work on workforce issues, and I strongly believe that the right employment situation can transform the life of an individual. Right now it happens to be people with disabilities, but any disenfranchised, underutilized aspect of our population that's not working to their full potential, I think it's in our best interest to do that. I liken it to that iceberg. We're working with the tip. But when you impact that person in a positive way, it impacts their family, their spouse, their children, future generations. I'm still an old-fashioned believer that work is the best social program. And one of the most effective social programs we've had has been the extended employment. Now, the association MORE has been the merger of three organizations that have existed in Minnesota for years, representing about 102 organizations providing services to about 16,000 plus individuals with disabilities in Minnesota, covering the entire state. all of you should be able to go into a provider in your district and see what they're doing and talk to the folks, and I'm sure they'd be happy to invite family members in and take you to job sites. And as Representative Gunther said, some committees have members have done this in the past. The EE funding is worth preserving and increasing. It's probably one of the more tax-efficient programs we offer. It's performance-based. If we don't deliver a unit of service, we don't get reimbursed. It's outcome-oriented. You provide the funds desired outcomes rather than need-based. You could argue whether that's right or not, but that's what it does. Working with providers leverages the resources they've developed over decades with businesses, fundraising, board members who are often family members or interested community people. So that connection with the department and providers to deliver the system, to deliver the services where appropriate, is a really good, efficient system. If you think about providers, they're that bridge between somebody with significant disabilities, or in other cases, it could be welfare to work or other programs, but in this case, people with disabilities, and that employer. You know, the employers are always happy to do it, and I'm glad to hear many, a few at least here, and I think more than a few, have employed individuals with disabilities. But for those that haven't, sometimes they're concerned with special considerations. The perceived potential increase for litigation should it not work out right. They might not admit that, but that's part of it. The low productivity and maybe lack of speed of some of the people we're trying to put in the job placements. Maybe less flexibility. How's the fit going to be in my workplace? I mean, there's all those concerns. A provider, or in some cases the state's the provider, we're that bridge to help them get through all those things. When we get through those barriers and have a successful example and a successful job placement, the next placements are easy and go well. So I think it's a good system. It's worthy of increases. Let's see, a lot of this was covered before, so maybe should I take Mr. Chair, should I take a stab at the wage, the 500-pound gorilla here and the wage issue?
Well, I think it would just be helpful, I think, for the members of the committee. You know, for example, when I toured your facility many moons ago, I believe you had some employees who were working at Arby's, for example.
Yes.
You kind of explain how that relationship works, where the funding sources come from, and just kind of explain how these individuals are integrated in the workforce, the value add, the PROACT supplies, and
yes,
and why the, for example, the reimbursement rate matters. That, you know, if there's more money put into the program with the same reimbursement rate, whereas if you increase the reimbursement rate with more money, how that trade-off impacts them.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out, and I think Kim Peck mentioned it, is that there's not a connection between the money we're paid for reimbursement by the services and the wage the individuals get. That when you're trying to do that, it doesn't work. First of all, special minimum wage certificates require that commensurate wages are paid. Quite simply, a commensurate wage requires that an individual with a disability get the same wage as somebody without a disability for the same quantity and quality of work. That's it in a nutshell. So part of what Representative Gunther was alluding to is they were trying to determine what would a worker without a disability do for productivity, measure the person with a disability against that productivity. Say they stock so many 100 shelves in an hour, and our folks could do 50 shelves an hour, that would be form the basis, if you meet all the other tests, to pay half the wage that the person stocking the shelf would get. It's highly regulated by the Department of Labor. I'm not going to try to defend whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, but it's been in place since 1937. The law was passed to prevent the curtailment of employment with disabilities. It kind of is a black eye for the industry, and I think it's a tough one to defend when you have somebody making less than minimum wage. I get that. But when we're talking about some folks with significant disabilities where there's kind of a productivity gap, I would call it, and that's what we have to deal with. If an employer needs to recover the amount they're paying in a wage, in a benefit package, and a little bit for the company and the square footage, they need to get so much productivity out of an employee typically. There are special circumstances or special cases, but in general, to happen on a large scale, that's what needs to happen. The wages are determined by law. So whether this rate went to zero or went to $20 an hour, the wage has to be paid the same. So based on that productivity, whether we get more money in a system or not, the wage has to go up. It's reviewed every 6 months. I heard somebody say that it's reviewed at least annually. For somebody out in the community, it has to be reviewed every 6 months. It typically goes up. It doesn't matter if we get money or not. The money we use to pay that wage in the case, and I'm going to take way more than my 3 minutes. I'll shorten this up.
No. It's important that you explain
okay.
this. So take your time.
There's a couple ways to do this. You know, when you think about one of the barriers is that concern if somebody hasn't had the experience with, you know, I don't care what group it is. It's if you have experience, it usually brings down barriers. So if we can get an employee into a job site and have them have that experience, it generally helps. So we will offer, providers will offer, I think all of them, most of them will offer to be the employer of record and say, if you will hire my person, I'll keep them on my payroll. You don't have to worry about workers' comp, unemployment comp, theft, whatever. We'll cover all of that. We have the insurance to do that. To do that, we've had a job developer, a job coach. We're involved in the community. That's what the hourly rate pays for, the structure to do that. Remember, we don't get reimbursed till a client works for an hour. Then we get $4.06. If they're in center-based, we get $1.91. There's built-in incentives to move them out. The other way to do that in the ultimate best outcome for somebody we serve is integrated competitive employment on the payroll of the employer. And hopefully we would fade that support off if somebody didn't need it anymore and discontinue it. As Kim Peck mentioned, for some of the folks that's harder to do in that system. So if the employer pays, they pay what they pay, they meet all the wage and hour laws. If we're at that employer of record, we have to pay wages based on productivity, quality, and quantity, regardless of what we reimbursed through a system that requires us to get a prevailing wage survey, things like that. So they're disconnected. When the minimum wage went up, and will go up again, it typically impacts the prevailing wage. The prevailing wage is rarely, if ever, the minimum wage. You can have somebody on a commensurate wage, special wage certificate that makes more than the minimum wage. If that prevailing wage is $16 an hour and somebody's at 15% or 50% productivity, they would be at the minimum wage. So not all special wage certificate wages are under the minimum. Most of them are, though, quite honestly. So there's that difference. The wage and benefit package would go with the employer of record. But the wages go up and are related to productivity, quality, and quantity, not the rate we get from the state. Get that.
Thank you. Do you have any other comments?
No, I'm hoping you'll support the bill. And I think one of the second piece on this is the Olmstead transition. That does, and you've heard all that, I won't repeat that, but I mean we are faced with kind of a daunting task. Most of individuals with pretty good chance for success has been moved out over the past, since 1984. So, you know, those that left to transition kind of require some special needs, and to deal with all that and transform our business model and all, that's part of what the money is statewide, is to let's help us kind of embrace the spirit of Olmstead and get everybody out. I'm going to speak for 100% of the providers. All providers are interested in the maximum level of employment for the people they serve. We're the ones with the boots on the grounds, looking the parents in the face, looking in the individuals in the face. We would like nothing better than to put ourselves out of business, getting everybody placed without supports in the community in this great state of Minnesota. So we are not dragging our feet. We're not obstructionists. We do have the task of making it happen, however, and that sometimes puts it at odds with the ideal, maybe. And with that, I'll end my comments. Be open to questions. Oh, and Lisa Harte just joined us and at the desk here, and she joined us because she had a special grant to try to move everybody out of a center-based setting and into the community. The other thing we're not talking about here is not just moving him out of the center into the community, but moving him out of some placements where we have groups of people at a business and getting those to individual placements. So the movement isn't just center-based. We want to, the ideal bar is, like I said, integrated community employment on the payroll of the business, not the provider. With that, I'll turn it over, Lisa.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Lisa Parte. I'm the director of Wavered Services for an organization called Functional Industries, located in Buffalo, Minnesota. Representative O'Neill is our district representative, and unfortunately she's not here today, but she has spent a couple of days with us getting to know our services, and that has been greatly appreciated, and we are really excited to continue developing that relationship with her. Functional Industries is an organization which provides an array of employment services to individuals with disabilities in Wright County, Sherburne County, and Stearns County. We offer, amongst these services, extended employment services, both center-based and community-based services. Functional Industries has been a longtime supporter of Olmsted and giving individuals as many choices as possible for work settings and supports. In 2010, as Steve alluded to, Functional Industries was awarded a $500,000 grant from DEED for a project which was named Enduring Vision. This was a pilot project set in motion to determine what exactly it would take to move individuals from that extended employment center-based program to community employment. The time frame that was involved with this initial project was approximately 17 months. As a quick overview of the project, there were 182 participants. Of these 182, 97 completed intakes into the program in hopes of obtaining community employment. 77 individuals chose that they did not want to leave the center-based programs, and 8 did not complete the intake process. They just kind of fell off the map. Of the 97 who completed intakes, 20 obtained supported employment. They were employed by community employers and had more than minimum wage jobs or minimum wage. Of the 182 who participated, 96 are now employed on community crews. So there was that movement from center-based to both community crews and to supported employment. The remaining individuals were either moved to more intensive services to that better met their needs, or they terminated services and now remain at home with no services at all. Some of the significant findings that we found with this project, which relate to why we're here today, there are significant barriers to obtaining community employment, such as individuals' lack of flexibility with their schedules. Individuals only want to work certain hours, certain days, and that makes it very difficult sometimes to find that community employment for them. Transportation, especially in the more rural areas, is very difficult. People don't have options for public transportation when you're working in greater Minnesota. Individuals choosing not to participate, and then guardians creating barriers to the process by not returning paperwork in a timely manner. On a funding level, it was found that there was not enough money to fund the supports necessary for success in the time frame that was given. Therefore, there's some individuals whose needs were too high to support and needed more training opportunities. They were moved to more intensive supports, and these supports were then funded by waiver dollars under the Health and Human Services budget. Unfortunately, as I understand it, the Health and Human Services budget is now being cut back, which again will limit the supports that can be provided for these individuals. Upon the completion of the Enduring Vision project, private sector funds were sought so that we could continue the project. We found that people wanted to work in the community, people wanted to move out of center base, and we wanted to see that happen, but how do we keep that going? So we ended up with a grant from Bremer Foundation to be able to continue that project and move forward. We were able to see success through Wright County and the Bremer Foundation. Unfortunately, as we all know, the public sector's funds are limited as well, and for them to be able to assist with moving people into the community can be very difficult because there are limited funds there. Of those who did not have access to waivered funds, there's one gentleman who's now sitting at home without services because he did not have any funding to pay for those more intensive supports that were needed. And he does not qualify for vocational rehab services. So there was nothing for him. There's kind of a void. The irony of the situation is that while we are working so hard to move people into the community and get them employed there, for some, the opposite effect happens. They end up with no services. There's many individuals we serve in our extended employment program in Greater Minnesota that have needs that disqualify them from vocational rehab services. This is Mary Ann. Mary Ann is one of these individuals. She has cerebral palsy and is confined to a wheelchair with very limited physical abilities. However, her mind is very sharp. She's very, very concerned about her future, and especially with the Olmstead Plan coming into effect. She has very real concerns that her future may consist of sitting at home without work because there are few employers who would hire her with her level of disability. In her exact words, "Work is very important to me. Without it, I do not feel good about myself. Who is going to hire me? I don't want to end up sitting at home." With that, I'm going to turn it over to Clayton.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Clayton Lynn, and I'm the Vice President of Programs and Service for the Occupational Development Center. Our organization has 9 locations throughout northern Minnesota. Bemidji, our corporate offices in Thief River. We also have offices in Warren and Baudette, Grand Rapids, Bemidji, Crookston, International Falls, and Buell. I'm also here as a member of MORE, and as Steve mentioned earlier, we wholeheartedly support this bill. In one of the biggest reasons, as was previously brought up, of course, was the Olmstead mandate. And I think the easiest way to look at it is that under Olmstead, they want to make sure that people aren't automatically just funneled into a sheltered workshop or a DTNH program or some other segregated setting.
What was the second term? What kind of program?
A DTNH program, or maybe sometimes called a day training and treatment.
And rehabilitation.
DTNH, day training and...
Day training and rehabilitation.
Okay. All right. Yep. I don't have... Of course I knew that acronym. I just did it for the sake of the committee. I just wanted to
make sure we knew it, right?
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't, so thank you.
And of course, they want to make sure that each individual has the opportunity to realize their full potential in employment. And I think that's something that we can all understand. But as we prepare to transition more individuals into the community in non-segregated environments, it's going to be a huge transition. And I think from one of the biggest issues that we're going to face, or biggest tasks that we're going to face, is education, not only for the consumers, but also their families and the businesses that we work with, and probably the general public too, on what individuals with disabilities can really do and get rid of a lot of the misinformation that's out there. As was brought up before, you know, there's a lot of misinformation about how the wages are determined for some people, or businesses are unsure if they should hire someone because they're afraid of liabilities. There's just a ton of misinformation that affects everybody. And also for the providers, we're going to need to be hiring additional staff to do the job search and job development duties that are going to be necessary to find jobs for these individuals. We'll need more job coaches to actually work with them and make sure that they're doing the jobs properly. And sometimes we just need staff to provide the transportation. And transportation seems to be becoming a larger and larger issue, especially all across the rural areas, it just never seems to end. A lot of times we get individuals to be hired into a position only to find out there's no transportation available for them, and the providers themselves end up needing to provide that individual's transportation, go pick them up, bring them to work, go pick them up, bring them home from work, and sometimes it's job coaching in between, but it varies from person to person. I think that also Kim Peck brought up that it's not just the Olmsted that's pushing the changes in integration, but it's also the WIOA, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that she mentioned, and then the Department of Justice is taking a major role in making sure that all these necessary changes take place. And the only way that we're ever going to be successful is we all work together to make sure that the consumers are getting the opportunities they deserve. And if we don't, if we're not successful, it's some of our most vulnerable citizens that are going to suffer because of it. So I ask that all of you support this bill for funding and enable us to move forward and get more and more people out into the community working. Thank you for here.
Thank you very much.
Presenter, please.
And there's a couple questions for our testifiers. So I think we all share the goal of moving disabled individuals from a sheltered workplace to community integration. But as you've somewhat alluded to, I mean, there's various reasons why that simply just is not in the best interests of the employee. To what degree are the regulatory and judicial agencies responding to this and recognizing that there is not a one size fits all approach to this? To what degree can we assist in making sure that they understand that while we all share that goal, that it's not 100% for everyone?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure that everyone is understanding that at the federal level. Just for example, if you look at some of the other states that have gone through the Olmsted process, they have just decided to eliminate, for example, the center base, and that's not appropriate.
Yeah, that's not a solution.
And it would leave some people behind, and where do they go? Some of these states are trying to figure out that now. And in the end, it ends up costing the state more money because they probably end up in residential programs that are much more expensive than the programs that we have. So I think the biggest thing that we all need to do is just learn more about the entire system and educate each other on what is happening.
Did you wish to elaborate?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Clayton is right. In other states, they have attempted this, and some have been successful. Some are still working on it. Washington State is a good example. They have taken people out of their center-based. There is no more center-based there. However, individuals who are working 5 days a week are now working maybe 2 hours a week, and the rest of the days they're sitting at home doing what? And that's one of Mary Ann's concerns. I work 5 days a week. This is really important to me, and now I may not work at all because who's going to hire me? Or if I only have one day, what am I going to do with the rest of my time? This is what we all know as we work in our jobs. Our job is really what defines us. And it's the same for the people with disabilities. Their job defines them, and if they don't have it or they don't have somewhere to go where they can do something productive, That can be very detrimental on their self-worth.
Yeah, and again, just to emphasize, I don't think anyone here is advocating that we want, that we're saying sheltered work is the goal for this program. We're simply saying that for a certain percentage of the client base, it really is in their best options and provides them the best opportunity to be productive. So it's disappointing to hear judicial organizations and outside groups not recognizing what is clearly a basic fact. Representative Gunther, do you have any additional comments before we move to?
I do. I think the Olmsted decision should have been a goal, not a mandate. I think if they would have made it a goal, I would have been 100% supportive of them. But at the same time, I see these people working. I don't go out there anymore because when I do, everything stops. And they all want to say hi. And the ones I hired, I got a real good deal because I got a Walmart greeter at the same time. I got somebody that had a defined task. So it was really, really quite a deal. We have people with Down syndrome. They're not going to be the same as someone that is less severely handicapped. And I think this program, as far as center base is concerned, the shelter workshop in Fairmont, Minnesota, got their own candy line. They package it, and you want to go into a Menards, you'll find it made in Fairmont by people at MRCI.
Well, I would hope that we can all stick together in the legislature in this one and make sure that we don't follow the behavior of other states in abolishing center-based employment. That is just not, it's just not smart, and it's not cost-effective. So, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure this is the question for these testifiers, but I chaired a committee very similar to yours, not quite as large, last year, and had to deal with some of the Olmstead conversations, and I was asking at the time, what's the dollar figure that this is going to take for we as a state to actually get our hands around and do it correctly and fund it on an ongoing basis. And I think that question got lost, not so much unanswered, but just lost in the rush to get out of session. And it would be really good if the department or departments could actually come together and kind of give us an idea. I don't know how many people were reading the newspaper the other day with the Kimberly Clark tax decision that's looking in front of us over the next couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
I think this is not just a one-year, the Olmstead is not a one-year problem or concern. It is a long-term concern, and we are going to have to, especially if it stays in this particular division, we're going to have to keep that in front of us, because I think this is more than a $12 million legislative appropriation. I think this is into the hundreds of millions of dollars of an appropriation. We better get our hands around it and start to understand what this is going to cost us as a state. Yeah. And I support the idea of it, and I want to fund it, and I don't think anyone doesn't. It's just we need to, in order to budget correctly, we need to have some idea of where we're going.
Okay. Representative Mahoney, bring up good points. And obviously, there's a broad strike zone of discretion that the legislature has in these matters, as well as the executive branch. And I just think anything that we can be doing in conjunction with the executive branch to communicate to the courts or to regulators that we all share the same goal, but a one-size-fits-all approach does not serve the best interests of these individuals. And the Kimberly Clark decision, yeah, we're probably going to lose that, so we're going to lose about $700 million. And
I'm going to believe we're going to win because I'm on the half
full. Yeah, well, and I'm a half full guy too, but I'm not half full of, yeah. So, are there any other questions for members of the committee? With that, Representative Gunther, any closing comments? Representative Gunther renews his motion that House File 1172 be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Gunther, and thank you to our testifiers. Representative Norton's here. Now, the chair moves House File 682 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Welcome to the committee, Representative Norton.
Thank you very much.
You may proceed with your testimony and presentation.
Wonderful. I have a bill before you today that makes a few small changes and clarifications in the law that we passed back in 2013 called the Destination Medical Center. And for the most part, the bill clarifies that the money spent by the city of Rochester, in support of the Destination Medical Center Corporation and the private EDA that's associated with the Destination Medical Center, count as part of Rochester's local match. And for those of you that weren't here when the Destination Medical Center law passed, it was an initial request of the state for $585 million of money to invest in infrastructure in the city of Rochester, the legislature, this body, made changes to that law and decided that there should be local contribution. And so through the negotiations and the hearings, it was determined that $128 million would be have to be a match from the city of Rochester, and there's a smaller appropriation from the county in order to get the remainder from the state of Minnesota, and it's given out over the next 20 years at a maximum of $30 million a year for infrastructure. After the city and Mayo Clinic proved to the Department of Economic Development that they have met their end of the bargain in building and infrastructure. Building and construction. So we're also making it clear that the expenditures on Rochester's special sales tax, which we gave them the authority to implement, and the general sales tax money that's spent on Destination Medical Center counts toward their 128. And I'm here because I think it was assumed that the private EDA would be funded by outside sources and perhaps and that the city would contract with, but it looks more like the city is going to be spending more money on that economic development association than was originally thought. And if that happens, it's certainly at the city's discretion how much they choose to spend, but that it should be part of that 128 that we imposed on them and not in addition to it, so that it will negatively affect the city's regular budget for the city of Rochester. That the mayor and the city council oversee, or that it will mean that there will be additional taxes imposed beyond what we originally invested or asked them to invest in the $128 million. So it's a fairly simple bill. It's been without controversy to this point, except that I do think that people don't all understand the Destination Medical Center, and so we're happy to be here to answer any questions, and we do have the city mayor and our city manager generally come down, but they have a city council meeting right now and couldn't be here. So we have with us their lobbyist, Bradley Peterson, who will answer any questions that you may have. And there is a letter from our city supporting this in your packets.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Peterson. Did you want to state your name for the record and offer any testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bradley Peterson. I'm with the firm of Flaherty & Hood here in St. Paul and here on behalf of the City of Rochester. Really don't have anything to add beyond Representative Norton's presentation of the bill, except that this does not change at all or increase the state's contribution. This really only has to do with the city's contribution and how it's going to be paid for.
Thank you. Representative Norton, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with House File 682? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this bill. Did you want to testify, sir, or not? Mr. Peterson, you might want to move to your left. There you go.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chairman Garofalo, my name is Mark Hughes. I'm a former Minnesota State Council member of 12 years. And Destination Medical Center is not only important for the city of Rochester, it's important for the state of Minnesota. I believe even the Twin Cities will create some job growth and some commuting between here and the Twin Cities, so I'm going to be brief, and I want everybody to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this bill and move to member questions. Member questions. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why wasn't this wording and all of this, why wasn't this part of the original bill last year, whenever it is we passed it?
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. Well, it was a large bill, and as I said, it started out as just a 585 direct appropriation from the state through bonding proceeds over the years. It was a value recapture proposal when it first started, and that pretty quickly, for a number of reasons, including our bonding capacity, that was decided that was not the direction we wanted to go. And so throughout the next, it was a short, well, 2013 will be a little bit longer, but throughout the hearings, the bill changed, and partly at the request of members in the tax committee who really wanted this to have the city and county really have a role in this and have it not just be a handout from the state. And so they likened it to other projects across the state, including Mall of America and others, and the Port Authority kind of is what they were thinking. And so through all the machinations of the hearings, we made some decisions, and frankly, at the end, some of the last changes in the end days of the session created the Economic Development Association as a private entity, not a state entity. And the City of Rochester already has an Economic Development Association, but it was felt that that couldn't concentrate on this project. And so we did the best we could to put together a bill that made sense at the time, only to find out that the city is going to be spending probably a considerable amount more. They've already spent, I believe, $8 million on the DMC Corporation Board, which has no, there was no authority to, or no appropriation for that, and the Economic Development Association. They've already spent $8 million, and I think there's four, is that correct?
That's what they're anticipating.
Yep. Anticipating for the next year, and that's going to go on for the, you know, for many years to come. And it just is not fair to the citizens of Rochester, who already got a surprise of $128 million additional taxation, to keep adding to that in addition to it. So I think it was just one of those, we thought private meant private when we formulated the policy for the EDA, but it really is going to be a partnership between the EDA and the City of Rochester. They will contract for a significant amount of it.
Representative Scott.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And is the governor in support of this bill?
The DMCC board, thank you, Mr. Chair. The DMCC board, which has Lieutenant Governor Smith as the director, is supportive of it, and Mayo's in the room too, and they understand the implication for our city, and they'll speak if you need them to.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then might we expect then members of that board and possibly even the chair herself to be lobbying us for passage of this bill?
I could ask them to if you'd like it. I didn't think it was necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You don't have enough. Any other questions for members of the committee? With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 682 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. You're on your way to taxes, Representative Norton.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
With that, members, that completes our agenda for the day. We are adjourned. Thank you.